Any questions for Mr. Gilliam at this point? Do you want to? Is there any?
We are in favor of when you look at the ban and what took place. It's a partial success in that you did remove plastic and the issues of litter and the things associated with the plastic bag. When I testified here a year ago, you know, there is no silver bullet bag. There's no perfect answer on all these bags. So you did get at that piece. So it needs to be broadened to include all retailers who have the plastic bags, not just a subset of the retail community. We also would support a 5-cent retail fee on paper bags. And the reason for that is if you talk about the a tax on food as a paper bag, the tax has already been increased and placed on the store when we did the plastic bag ban. The plastic bag ban cost each store roughly $23,000 a year in new costs because plastic bags are cheaper than paper bags. So to replace those bags and the usage, and on the sheet you can see the actual usage that we had, it comes out to $23,000 a year that each store, grocery store, is now in new costs, is now passing on to its consumer. One thing the nickel on paper achieves actually does two things. One, it encourages people to use reusable. Now, you may have an issue with that, and that's okay. But the other thing it does is that it doesn't put the cost shift of that $23,000 for someone who chooses paper on someone who chooses to use a reusable. So it's more of a pay-as-you-go. Is it an embedded cost? Can we embed the cost? Sure we can. We embed electricity, labor, everything else. It's absolutely true. But we're on a 1% profit margin, so these costs do affect us. If you want to know what that means in sales to us, when you add a cost of $23,000, there's a very simple rule in grocery. Just add two zeros to the end of that figure. And that's what we have to do in sales, new sales, to make up for the cost that was put on us. If not, and we can't find those new sales, which sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, then it's a price increase in order to remain level at a 1% profit margin. So the cost has been incurred, and the tax has been made at $23,000 a store. That's for the first 6 months, so it's $46,000 a year. So that's kind of just the numbers, how they come out. The only other suggestion I would have would be fluoridated reusable bags to get Mr. Leonard on.
Enough from you, your time's up.
No, we expect that kind of stuff from your brother.
Yeah, exactly.
Not from you.
I'm his little brother.
You.
Would you like to go, ma'am?
Sure. My name's Jessica Miller. I'm the Director of Community Outreach and Marketing for Food Front Cooperative Grocery Stores here in Portland. We have two stores. One that is 40 years old and has never, ever offered single-use plastic bags. The other that's 5 years old. And we fully support the ban the bag efforts and the extension into the possible charge of 5 or 10 cents, whatever it might be. And we do believe it would encourage people to use reusable bags rather than paper. In addition, with that money that we would get back, we don't see it as affecting our bottom line because, as everybody said, the costs are already there. We already pay for them. We didn't incur more costs because of the plastic bag ban, but we see this as a way to give back to community. So I couldn't speak to exactly who those nonprofits would be, but we already do quite a bit charitably, and this would be yet another way to just put that money back into our community. There's a lot of good arguments and maybe jobs about, you know, paper locally, but people are still going to buy the bags, and they're not going to go away. It's just encouraging people to use reusable bags, and I think there's plenty out there. We all have 10 or 20 at home. Perhaps you bring them and donate them, and nobody actually has to buy a new reusable bag. There's several different ways to go about that. And so on behalf of our two stores, we, you know, our revenue is about $12 million a year. We're not a Target with a $600 million a year revenue. We're very local. We support our farmers. We support, you know, we provide jobs. We really do give back to the community, and we support this. So,
thanks for your testimony.
Could you tell us where the two food fronts are located?
Sure. The original store is located in Northwest Portland on 23rd and Thurman. or 23rd Place in Thurman, and then the other one is in the Hillsdale Shopping Center, really central to that community and its vibrancy. So we're, you know, we've got a lot of people behind us, about 8,600 owners, and we're owned by our community. So,
thanks very much.
And I'm one of the owners.
Yes, you are. Thank you.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning, excuse me. My name is Rob Cochran. I live in Southeast Portland. And for the last several months, I have been going door to door, canvassing in the evenings, talking to people about the opportunity that we have to expand Portland's plastic bag ban. I talked to about 40 people a night, 5 days a week, from the hours of 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. every night. And I would say that the overwhelming majority of the people that I speak with on a nightly basis are in favor of expanding Portland's bag ban. I would like to address Commissioner Leonard's concern about, you know, villainizing paper bags. And the idea is not to laud the benefits of paper bags over plastic bags, although many will consider that they are the lesser of two evils. The idea in expanding Portland's plastic bag ban is that at some point we have to move beyond this mindset of use it once and throw it away. If we are to expand or protect our oceans, protect the environment for generations to come, a lot of times the only objections that I get out there when I'm talking to people at the door, most of the time, it's like, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to be forced to buy bags to line my trash can. What am I going to pick up my pet waste with? You know? And at what point are we willing to accept a certain amount of inconvenience in order to move forward? Paper bags are not that great over plastic bags. That's not what this is about. The fact is that if we're going to sustain this world, and if we're going to keep Portland as a leader in sustainability for the Northwest and for our state, it's really up to us as the largest city in the state of Oregon to take that next step. Last year, I was very proud when our city took the first step and became the first city in Oregon to ban the bag. Now it's time to take the next step to move forward. Because the idea is not to ban paper bags, ban. People have a real fear of this word ban. But it is our government's responsibility to protect the public interest and to act in favor of the public interest and not special interest groups who are promoting propaganda to protect their interests. We have to make sure that city council and that we as citizens do what is right to protect our home. Oregon is our home. Portland is our home. And we don't want these things around. And we have an opportunity to do that now, and I urge the city council to take that action. Thank you very much.
I can respond to one, since you brought up my name and what I said. I did not say use a paper bag and throw it away. I and everybody I know recycles them.
So that's true.
Your argument isn't helping me.
Only 5% of the plastic bags that we use in Oregon are actually ever recycled.
I'm talking about paper bags.
Mm-hmm, paper
and
bags.
What I feel like here is there is some of what we call mission creep a little bit. You're now all of a sudden vilifying paper bags in a way that I don't recall that occurring a year ago and suggesting people throw them away. We have a robust recycling program in Portland. I know of virtually no one that would throw a paper bag away. They're recycling.
That's very true.
And people put their food scraps in them.
That's very true.
Put them in the recycling. So,
are you talking about paper bags or plastic bags?
No, I'm talking about paper bags.
Paper bags,
yes,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were characterizing it as though we have to get away from this throwaway society.
Right.
And we have. And we recycle.
But they still wind up in landfills. And since the bag ban...
What if they do? They biodegrade.
That's true. But the fact is that, you know, the cost of producing paper bags also has a carbon imprint on the environment. And so it's not to say that paper bags are so much better. We want everybody to use paper bags instead of plastic bags. What we really want people to do is to think more sustainably. and to begin to use reusable bags. If you go to the grocery store and you're going to buy one bag of groceries and you forget to bring your reusable bag, you know, you might have to pay 5 or 10 cents fee for that, right? Not a big deal. But if you're going to the grocery store and you're buying 10 or 20 bags of groceries, and suddenly you're forced to pay, you know, 50 cents or a dollar.
You're not helping me. you really aren't. Your argument is having the opposite effect on me.
So
all right.
Ask the questions of the panelists, too. And, you know, I want to start out by saying I appreciate the Northwest Grocery Association, you know, coming out in favor of this plastic ban in Salem here last year, too. I appreciate working with groups like Surfrider, but, you know, again, I just think a tax on food is not good. And I guess, well, maybe it's our concern. It is our concern to the city council to worry about impacts on the environment, mm-hmm. you know. Nevertheless, we made a big gain last year. We banned plastic bags.
We did.
Reusable bags are up 300%. So it's also a concern to this council, and we've talked and acted a lot on this issue about food security and people's ability to afford food. And so I guess I know a lot of your retailers already offer a nickel off. I mean, I get a nickel off when I bring my reusable bags. So what's wrong with that?
Councilman,
and I guess the food front offer such yeah. a. Do you offer a nickel off when people?
We actually
bring
it? Give it to charity. We don't. Yeah. We don't give the customer the discount. We donate 5 cents to a local charity. We change it on quarterly or monthly.
Okay. So I mean, what's wrong with that as an incentive in of itself to? Again, bring your reusable bag.
You defer a cost. If you bring your reusable bag back and we're not giving you a paper bag, then that saves us about 7 cents, 5 to 7 cents, depending if it has handles or you know, how thick a bag it is. So there is, you know, giving that off is just coming out. Breaking
yeah, so, I mean, isn't that
just
incentive?
Breaking even, but I mean, not
the same incentive yeah. we're looking for. You're talking about a nickel on paper bags as an incentive to use reusable bags. I guess I'm saying we're already getting 5 cents.
What our goal is,
and that's, yeah. you know,
what our goal is that we don't support a dime. We think that's too much. Mm-hmm. We think a nickel is appropriate. Gentle reminder that you can avoid the nickel if you want to, if you bring your own bag in. And we're encouraging people to bring back in their paper bag and using it twice or three times. You get about three uses out of a paper bag. It doesn't have to be a fabric bag. And so there are some that are offering incentives. There are others that you know, sell a cheaper reusable bags. There's one down to a quarter right now. It's shaped like a plastic bag, but it's reusable. So there's different innovations to do that in the marketplace. But when you talk about the cost shift that the first part of this ordinance put on us, you've already raised the price of groceries by voting for a plastic bag ban. We've had to incur, it's going to be $46,000 a year per store. Now add that up for 55 stores across the city, and it gets pretty high pretty quick. That's already happened. So the issue now is why we're supporting the 5 cents, is for those to pay as you go and not pass their cost. If they just say, I'm not going to use reusable, I'm not going to do it, then they pay for their bag. Those who bring in their reusables don't pay that cost, and it's completely avoidable, and we're encouraging our folks to bring their paper bags back two and three times and use them up and then put them in the recycle bin. There's a lot of good things about paper bags.
And I appreciate what you're saying. I just think there's kind of an inherent assumption in this that grocers should be compensated for the plastic bag ban, and therefore, you know, last year have us ban the bag, plastic bag, and you know, and quite frankly, I think there was some agreement struck between Surfrider and the Grocers Association to come back this year and go for the nickel or a dime on the paper bags as sort of a quid pro quo, and I return my original question. Is this a good time to be taxing people on food consumption? You're saying in one way they're paying it already, but is this a good time to be doing that? Just with hunger at its record levels in this state and this city.
Commissioner, I think we just disagree on how that charges. We've already been hit with the cost, and we're saying there's a better way to do that and get results. People pay as you go with the nickel and paper. You aren't cross-subsidizing those who bring reusables. And we're recovering our cost of what you imposed on us last year. I was not in favor of the ban last year in its form without the nickel and not being applied to all retailers, and I testified before. So just to clarify my position, we were not happy about only being grocery, only being drug. We don't think that's fair.
And I hear you. I hear you on that point.
So what's in front of us is, again, a discussion about status quo. Expand it from the 160-odd stores that it applies to now, and looking at the whether or not to add a fee. Those are the options for public discussion, and that's we're required by the ordinance to come back for a report. We've accomplished that today. I will be conferring with my colleagues. We'll be conferring with the community and all stakeholders and figure out which of those three are hybrids of those three. I think the discussion is really important, and I think it's robust. But remember, in addition to status quo, it's also, do we want to expand it beyond 167 stores? So don't lose sight of that as what other communities have done as well. So
which I
appreciate
it. We haven't discussed that here today, but I think philosophically, I don't see how one could support banning plastic bags in the larger stores and not in the smaller stores as well.
I thank you for your testimony. You may all return to your seats. All right, so I have fulfilled my obligations under the previous ordinance.
Is there more testimony?
No, that was it.
Two more people signed up.
Oh, sorry, they just signed up.
Tara Gallagher and Sarah Higginbotham.
Hi, welcome. Anyone else want to testify? This is your last opportunity. Okay.
We actually, in our defense, thought we were signed up and
I
apologize.
Problem.
Hi, my name's Sarah Higginbotham. If that's okay, I'll just jump right in.
Go for it.
I'm the state director at Environment Oregon. I've met some of you. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting others. Environment Oregon's a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization. I'm here today to represent the thousands of members that live in the city of Portland. First and foremost, I'd like to applaud and thank the City Council for being the first city to step up to the plate and take action against plastic bag waste by banning plastic bags at major retailers last year, so thank you. Not only has plastic bag use dropped, but reusable bags have increased in use, and so that's some laudable progress. Since the passage of Portland's bag ban, we have seen Oregonians continue to push on this issue around the state. Corvallis enacted a more comprehensive policy that you've heard about, and that is in your report, that covers all retailers. And then the City of Eugene is currently considering that same policy and that same model. What we've also seen up and down the West Coast is a continued movement to address the plastic waste that's polluting our oceans and polluting our environment. This summer, California had the 50th city ban plastic bags. We know that about a third of the state is either living in or about to live in a plastic bag-free community. That's huge progress. That includes Los Angeles and San Francisco. In the state of Washington, we have seven cities that have banned plastic bags, including Seattle. That's also huge progress. And I'd like to note that the vast majority of those cities in California and in Washington have all adopted a more comprehensive model than Portland initially did. Portland's bag policy in 2011 was a fantastic start, but let me be very clear, it did not go far enough. And I'm going to bring the conversation here back to plastic. You all probably heard quite a bit about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in 2010 and 2011. I'm here to report in 2012, it's still there. It continues to wreak havoc on our marine mammals, on our seabirds, and continued studies are released with frequency about the effects of this plastic. I'd also like to quickly draw your attention to the article at the cover of the Oregonian on September 25th that highlighted the vast amount of toxic microplastics that are on our beaches. In about one square meter on Crescent Beach, an advocate pulled out a half a pound of plastic waste just in one square meter on one of our Oregon beaches. So the question of how much longer we can ignore the results of us using this non-biodegradable plastic I think why so many of us are here today. So to be very clear, Portland can continue to make meaningful progress on this, commissioners, and so what Environment Oregon supports is an expansion of the current bag ban policy to all retailers with a phased-in approach that also includes restaurants. To mitigate the increased use in paper bags, we also do support what other cities have paved the way on, which is that pass-through cost disincentive fee on paper bags, and we support a 10-cent charge there. I'd also just like to quickly add, I'm submitting a letter as well that includes the support of not only the Portland Surf Rider Foundation, the Portland Audubon Society, Tualatin Riverkeepers, Oregon Shores, and Oceana, who all support an expansion that will cover more retailers to really address all of the plastic that's coming out of our retailers and our restaurants. I also want to thank Rob, who came up. He's a member of Environment Oregon Citizen Outreach Team, and to all the volunteers and Citizen Outreach folks. We have talking to people on doorsteps every day today about this issue. Thank you so much.
And my understanding is that in cities like San Francisco, Seattle, and Corvallis, that the TANF food stamp WIC recipients also trail card also are exempt from the 5-cent fee. Is that accurate?
It's accurate with a caveat. So WIC, women, infants, and children can are addressed in that issue because of federal regulation about discrimination on TANF.
Okay.
There are some different ways to try and work around that. So you can't actually identify someone based on being a TANF recipient and ask them for a bag. But there are some different ways, such as just having those bags there. If someone wanted to ask for one, for example.
WIC and food stamps in some of those cities then are exempt from the 5-cent fee.
The WIC is, yeah. Yes, correct. Absolutely.
And here with our Oregon Trail Card, we have Oregon Trail Card, which is our food stamps. Great. Thank you. Hi.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Tara Gallagher. I am the vice chair for the Portland chapter of Surfrider Foundation. And I agree with everything Sarah just said. I had some prepared remarks. I also think I need to address a couple of the points that have been made. As a grassroots organization, we really see this as a watershed issue. As volunteers and stewards of the city, we really intimately know the problems associated with plastic bags. Those have been reiterated to you over and over again. When we're marking storm drains, when we're cleaning ivy out of parks, when we're cleaning up trash from our rivers, plastic bags are everywhere. We've gone over the problems associated with those. But again, the current ban has done a lot. It's not gone far enough. There's a lot more plastic bags out there. And we do also need to address this issue of single-use, well, with paper bags. Basically, I take real issue, with all due respect, Commissioner Saltzman, with you calling this a tax. First of all, it is not mandatory. And this also, when it was in the Oregon legislature, was looked at. And under Oregon law, this is not a tax. So I just want to make that very clear as we go forward. I'd also like to address that paper bags aren't the villain, but we do have climate action goals in Portland that we addressed in the last ordinance. And to meet some of those goals, we need to start looking at our practices. As Portland residents, we understand that this expansion can't really happen without a lot of outreach and education. That's why over the last 4 years, Surfrider has reached out to hundreds of businesses, talked with thousands of Portlanders, tabled at numerous community events, and even helped sponsor a bus ad with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to help with their Bring Your Bag outreach. We've also given out thousands of reusable bags to residents. Portlanders really do pride themselves on sustainability, and they are ready for a better bag ban. I'd like to thank you again for your leadership on this issue, especially Mayor Adams, and I really hope you will consider a more comprehensive bag ban.
Thank you all very much. All right. We're going to take a quick break, a compassion break, and get ready for the next topic. So we're adjourned, or we're in recess for 7 minutes. Not 8 minutes, not 6 minutes.
Oh my God.
We got it. We're done.
Randy just turned it over to you.
Okay. That's okay. Did you see him over there, Dave? They got the floating crane.
No, I
and
didn't.
Barge out in front of the fire station. They're pulling out the old pilings.
Mic checking. One, two.
Incremental.
Yes.
What we need to do on the stage. Cool.
Test one, test two. That sounds
like taxing children. Taxing children wasn't good enough, or taxing food wasn't good enough.
How's it going, Jennifer?
Good.
Good to see you back.
Twice in one day, what an honor.
I know, right? We're up early. But.
I'm usually here at 6.
So, Carla, we'll come back. 2 seconds. We'll come back from recess. And, Carla, can you please read the title for non-emergency time certain ordinance 1134?
Ratify a successor collective bargaining agreement between the city on behalf of Portland Fire and Rescue and the Portland Firefighters Association relating to the terms and conditions of employment of represented employees in the Portland Firefighters Association bargaining unit for 2012-2016.
Commissioner Randy Leonard.
I'm going to turn this over to Anna Canwett.
Great, thank you. Anna Canwett, Bureau of Human Resources. Patrick Ward is with me as well, who was the chief spokesperson on the city side on the contract. Chief Jansen's is here, and also Alan Furschweiler, who's the vice president of the Portland Firefighters Association. Jim Forquet, who's the president, is out of town, so wasn't able to come. We have before you the tentative agreement that was negotiated on behalf of the city with the Portland Firefighters Association. We began negotiations last April and reached a tentative agreement in September, which is really excellent. As you all know, these negotiations often drag on quite a long time, but we were able to work really collaboratively with the Bureau, of course, and with the Firefighters Association as well. And I'm just going to take a quick second and read a text message I got from Jim Forquet about the contract, because he could not be here, but basically said he was pleased with the results. It was ratified by the Portland Firefighters Association, and he stated that he believes we have established some great relationships that will contribute to our future success. I think that's really important. We had several overarching goals with this contract. One was a citywide goal of reducing overtime costs. A second was to focus on the importance of prevention. This is a goal that the new chief has, is also in keeping with the changing fire service.
Yeah, right.
And finally, obtain an agreement of sufficient duration. This is a 4-year agreement that would allow the fire chief to work effectively with her labor management committee in order to put forward some of her initiatives and take the Bureau in a new direction. Again, this is key because, as we know, with even 3-year agreements, often we take a significant period of time to negotiate those agreements, and then there can be issues post-agreement, and we're generally back in negotiations with about a year of labor peace. So we think this is a very effective way to be establishing the Bureau under Chief Jansen. So as I stated, the tentative agreement is for 4 years, which is in keeping with that one goal. It is calls for a COLA cost of living increase July 1st of each year with the floor of 1% and the ceiling of 5%, which is consistent with what is in all of our other labor agreements. The PFFA members who require replacement when they work overtime are no longer allowed to take compensatory time off. The overtime will have to be paid in wages. This is a cost savings to the Bureau. It's somewhat undercosted in the information we gave you, but when you have to bring people back in, as you do with a 24/7 operation, the cost of overtime goes to 2.25. It's not 1.5%, so it does increase considerably. Also made a couple of changes to the agreement that works towards achieving the goal that I stated in terms of a focus on prevention. One is to attract certified paramedics to accept assignments outside of emergency operations. Those paramedics will now receive a premium of 3%. Otherwise, when they left to go outside of emergency operations, they would lose an 11% premium. So there's very little incentive for people to move into these other areas, which is key as an incentive.
Curiosity, what are the other areas besides emergency operations?
We have a training division as well as a prevention division that okay. people are allowed to work.
Okay. The secondary benefit is that there will be increased numbers of actually certified paramedics in the event that we had a major disaster or emergency. The second premium is for fire inspectors. For an Inspector 2 certification, we'll receive a 6% premium. And again, that preserves the focus on prevention and does require a course of study. It isn't simply filling out a form and obtaining that certification. There is a significant amount of work that goes into that. And that is something where the costing, as it will get to, is somewhat overstated, as it assumes everyone will actually obtain that certification, and we don't think that will be the case, but did cost it as if that would happen, so you have the full impact. The harbor pilots, there is a 6% premium. This has been an issue for the Firefighters Association for some time. They actually brought it to our attention about a year ago, or maybe a little more than a year ago. And at that time, we said, look, let's roll that into bargaining rather than negotiate that as a separate issue. They were willing to do that. Based on the comparable information they provided, the harbor pilots were making approximately 30% over firefighters. The 6% premium that we've put in place keeps that at approximately 21%. So we are still under what other jurisdictions are providing to the harbor pilots. The city agreed to eliminate the 12-hour vacation payback for firefighters on the 24-48 schedule. This was a very critical issue for the Portland Firefighters Union. It does reduce the work week by approximately, it's just under 14 minutes. So the average work week is now 51.69 hours. And that puts us still very much in line with our comparable jurisdictions. There are jurisdictions that have a slightly longer work week than we do, and there are jurisdictions such as Seattle with a shorter work week than the city of Portland. It's not a change in the salary, but it does, because it's a change in the hourly rate. The costing that you'll see for that is due to the impact on overtime, comp time if it's taken, which can still be taken by non-emergency personnel, and those associated costs, but it doesn't actually change the salary of the PFFA members. You will see there is no premium for the rapid response vehicles, consistent with council direction, nor is there any change to the existing company inspection program. So getting to some of the costing, costing over the life of the contract, so it's a four-year agreement. In year one, there is a savings of the elimination of the comp time of approximately $21,000. There's a small increase in the education benefit and union release time, but the first year of the contract, which is the current fiscal year, there's actually a savings to the Bureau. There's no additional cost because the premiums, the new premiums and the reduction in the work week via elimination of the 12-hour vacation payback do not kick in until the second year of the contract. In that year, you will see the cost of the work week reduction is $168,000. The harbor pilots is just over $69,000. The Inspector 2 certification, again, this assumes everyone obtains the certification, is $146,000. Those are the primary cost items, which is $441,000 for that year. Those premiums, of course, for the next 2 years of the contract go to $602,000, well, not the premiums, the package, $602,000 and $618,000. The total you'll see in the ordinance of the cost of the agreement is approximately $1.6 million. The cost to FPDNR is fairly minimal. It's about $102,000, and that's really almost exclusively due to the COLA projections is what is driving the increased cost to the pension.
Did you say the five-year cost was?
No, that's we only caught the cost of over the life of the contract, not a five-year cost. There is the five-year.
I guess OMF did a five-year cost of 2.5. $2.8 million.
Yes. Yeah, that carries it out beyond the life of the contract. That is okay. Accurate, Commissioner.
So the 1.6 is 4 years.
That's the okay. Yes. The 1.6 that's in the ordinance is the life of this contract only.
And am I correct that the COLA would be assessed to the general fund increases as others, but the rest of the increases, fire and rescues, as said, that would not be added to the CAL each year? They would absorb it within their existing budget?
That was not the agreement that we had, Commissioner. It's a discussion we have with the Bureau when we negotiate changes in the contract, that they may be required to absorb those costs, but it's not the, you know, Bureau of Human Resources place to, you know, mandate how those costs are assessed. That's really council's decision.
So it's my understanding, if Mayor or Commissioner Leonard, correct me if I'm wrong, but the question of whether the new costs are built into the CAL or absorbed by the Bureau or some combination is something we know the council takes up, not
every
not,
budget here.
We take it up in the course
here.
Of our budget. Mm-hmm. And so my guess is the first opportunity we'd have to discuss that would be our budget retreat. But that ultimately is a council decision, not a...
Which I'm looking forward to.
The retreat.
Yeah.
And Randy, you may say we're looking forward to having you there.
Uh-oh.
I won't be there.
You won't be there.
That's why I'm looking forward to it.
So, a guest.
But I don't want to put words in your mouth. Right. Did I just accurately state our protocol?
Yes, absolutely. That is correct. So, as I said, I think they are...
Our protocol.
Nope.
He's very eloquent when you call in, Randy.
The costs, we believe that the savings and the comp time are somewhat understated, but more important on that issue, that continues council goal. We set the stage for that in our other negotiations as we continue per what has the auditors looked at in their audits that we need to reduce the overall overtime expenditures by the city. The union and the city worked very hard to reach the agreement on this issue. We think it's a very fair agreement. And again, PFFA ratified last Thursday by a very, very good margin. And, you know, one of the issues with this agreement, too, when we tried to look at really what was the one critical issue for the union and address that is PFFA did assist the city in our last negotiations because they were the first union to support and accept the zero COLA increase, which, again, did help set the stage for our bargaining with the other bargaining units and was a benefit to the city's overall budgeting that year. So I don't have any other further comments. I know that Alan wanted to make a comment on behalf of the PFFA, so open that up to you.
Yes, unless you have any questions before that.
I did have a question about the overtime for the public involvement. Public information officer, why, when there are so many senior staff in the fire bureau, presumably on scene, why is there an additional compensation for being the public information officer?
Is that the backup pay, Commissioner?
Item 10 in the contract, public information officer compensation.
Yeah, that's the backup pay, and the chief can speak more detail to this, but it's really an equity issue because we have backup PIOs on a 52-hour week and a 40-hour week. Work week, and they were getting paid differing amounts, and so that's this change. But
why are we paying the backup PIOs anyway when we have a lot of command staff who presumably can speak for the Bureau?
The command staff are all have emergency scene responsibilities on scene that are critical to our firefighter and public safety. So they are occupied taking care of the emergency scene, and in order to, if we were to assign a more senior officer PIO responsibilities, it would essentially create another position. We have an enormous amount of response just for public information requests for our normal response duties. So we have an individual, just one, who is assigned as a primary public information officer who works a 40-hour work week. The backup PIOs can work. Some of them work a 40-hour work week. Some of them have a 51.6, what will be a 51.69-hour work schedule, and there's a pay discrepancy in when they are called back. There's a pay discrepancy in their callback time, so it was really an equity issue.
Any other questions?
Well, go ahead. I do have a couple questions, but go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So, again, for the record, Alan Firschwaller, I'm vice president, one of the vice presidents for Portland Firefighters Association. Jim Forquet was not able to make it, asked that I come in his place. This collective bargaining agreement is on the back of our last two-year collective bargaining agreement. And I just wanted to reiterate some of the things that happened during that bargaining cycle. One, again, successful agreement by both the city and the union to pass that collective bargaining agreement. One of the highlights in there for our members that we wanted to discuss was that one of those years is that we did take a zero cost of living. The second year, one of the other changes that happened is we went from a floor to a 2-5 floor, which has been pretty standard in our contracts throughout the past 10 or 20 years, down to a floor of 1. And again, that's a significant change that happened during that collective bargaining year. So fast forward to where we're at right now. Again, it really shows part of the success that we have in the labor management scenario at the Fire Bureau, between the Fire Bureau, the city, and the union. Because there's a definitely agreement that's on the table that has some sticking points for some of our members. Definitely our members didn't want to do a four-year deal. The comp time is really, even though it's a small amount of a savings, it's really a really important issue to our members. And I'll give you my own example is for training classes or time outside of my regular work schedule, I would be allowed to get comp time. And I've got three little girls at home, so what it meant is that if I give the Bureau 8 hours during a class, I would be able to have 12 hours off and not take the money. And so I would be able to spend a lot more time with, or I'd be able to spend time with my family, which I've already paid the city for. So that's really what that comp time was used for, is a lot of that type of, you know, for the growing of people of families. And so it was a really valuable, even though the number's small, it really was a really valuable thing that our membership voted to get rid of. The other thing is that, again, going to the 1-5 CPI, our members, especially when we started this collective bargaining agreement, really wanted to see that go back to a 2-5, which we are not successful in getting. But that being said, this is probably, when you have your membership ratify a vote by 87%, it shows that our membership really is in tune with what's happening in the economy. They care about the city, they care about their employer. And in times, in those 2 years, I would like to say just one more quick thing is, you know, as our members watch what's happening to our other members, there's some significant events that have happened in our membership. I think if you watch TV and you watch KGW, you watch one of our firefighters fall through the roof on a second alarm fire. We just had another lieutenant that got third-degree burns in a house fire up in North Portland. One of our members, it wasn't a FPNR didn't approve the claim, but took MRSA home to a six-month-old daughter. And so as we pass this agreement, that's a lot of the things that our members really say, is they say, our job still is very dangerous. We do a very good job at what we do, and we believe that compensation package that we've been able to reach for you with the city really reflects that in these economic times. So I appreciate you allowing us to speak here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Additional questions, Commissioner, on the agreement?
Well, I think the example Alan used is probably the best way for me to understand the comp time change. Okay, so you described where you took 8 hours of training, gave you 12 hours of comp time. So how does that change now under this new contract, just using that same example?
And half comp time.
So I would be forced to take overtime, and so there will be no more comp time.
For the 8 hours?
Yes.
For the training, you would be paid overtime to do the training.
Right, you're paid time and a half for the actual hours worked over the regular schedule, rather than taking having the time off at time and a half when we have to replace somebody. So it's not someone coming in and take training; it's someone replacing Alan in emergency operations.
And that's training that's above and beyond the training that we do during the course of our day that we can break from and we can respond on emergencies. It's for training that is mandatory training to require. For example, in Alan's case, for his paramedic certification, where we have to pay an instructor to come in and teach a large group of people once or twice a year, so they have to be in that training and are not allowed to leave. So that training, if we continued to allow the comp time, we would then have to pay somebody a time and a half for the 12 hours that Alan received. So I understand the value of it to our members, and also to the taxpayers.
And then my
other question was, I just forgot it.
Are there any other? Thinking,
yeah.
I just actually want to make a comment because we're not voting on this today.
Correct.
So we may not see all of you again. Actually, Jim may be here next week, Alan. But
yes, he will be.
You said something, Alan, a moment ago I just wanted to reflect on, and that was you attributed, you explained why you had such a high rate of ratification. And you talked about the fact that your members are aware of the current environment, the climate, the economy, and I think that's probably true. I think Commissioner Leonard would agree with me, though you left out one important factor. We read the paper every day of tentative agreements being shot down by bargaining units in the public and private sector, and it is typically the case that the leadership does not recommend or allow something to go south. So let me just acknowledge while you're here that I think that 87% vote is in part a tribute to the leadership of the union, because without good leadership, then the rank and file, you know, may or may not accept the work that you've done. But it takes leadership to say that this is a tough hand, but this is times we're in, and this is why we recommend it. And it's not unusual nationally for leaders of unions to put before the members a proposal, but not endorse it or not put the muscle behind it. And so, and I just would say, I wish Jim was here, but, you know, he reaches out to every member of this council on a pretty regular basis. And four of us don't have direct oversight of the Bureau, since we're not commissioners in charge. And I think it's just an example of a leadership style of making sure there's good communication and that we're having a good dialogue. And doesn't mean we're always going to agree on every subject, but I would just want to acknowledge that, because not every labor partner that we have goes that extra mile. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to echo that, too, because I did talk with Jim as he went out talking to the members, and the vote doesn't reflect some of the, we'll be polite and say, conversations he had at the fire stations, dialogues, which I'm intimately familiar with. And so I shared his pain, felt his pain as he was telling me the types of conversations that he was having as he went to every station, every shift, every 40-hour spot, which is a lot. So that I appreciate Commissioner Fish acknowledging the leadership part, because I've sat here and watched a different style as well. And it's counterproductive for the union and the city and the Bureau. And so I too, greatly appreciate.
Thank you.
I would echo the same comment. We enjoy a very, very strong labor management relationship, and the union leadership is really a key component of that. And what we are met with, reason and support and positive actions going forward.
I remembered my question, and maybe it's not really a question, but Anna, you were saying lauding the PFFA for, in our last contract, being the first bargaining unit to accept a 0% cost of living adjustment. And you were saying, I think you were saying, this current agreement with PFFA, again, is setting the stage for future bargaining around comp time with other bargaining units.
Around the larger issue, Commissioner, of overtime. Comp time is an issue for some of our bureaus and some of the operating units within the bureaus for our overall negotiations. But overtime as well, and how we pay that, continues to be an issue, because the city does pay a standard that's more generous than what state or federal law would require us to pay on overtime.
And I, too, want to add my accolades to the Firefighter Association leadership and to the members of the Firefighters Union and to our labor negotiations people. I do think this is a very fair agreement, and I know, you know, sometimes fair is a hard rot thing to achieve. Mm-hmm. So I will be supporting this next week.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay. Do we have anybody signed up to testify, Carla?
No one else signed up.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you all.
We'll be back next week.
We'll go to our regular agenda now. Item 1148.
1148, accept a grant in the amount of $70,000 and appropriate $55,000 for the fiscal year 2012-13 from the Oregon Department of Transportation, Transportation Safety Division, 2013 Multnomah County DUII Intensive Supervision Program for sworn personnel overtime.
Do we have anybody here from the Bureau? Okay, well, it sounds pretty self-explanatory. We're getting a grant from the state for DUI enforcement. Sounds good to me. Anybody wish to testify? Okay. Carla, please call the roll.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye. The item passes, and we move on to 1149.
Adopt findings and authorize an exemption to the competitive bidding process to procurement services pursuant to ORS 279C and PCC 5.34 and provide payment for construction of the Portland Building Envelope Restoration and Structural Improvements Project.
Christine Moody.
Christine Moody, Procurement Services. The ordinance you have before you asks for an exemption to the traditional low bid process, allowing for procurement services to use an RFP process to select a construction manager general contractor for the Portland Building Envelope Restoration and Structural Improvements Project. Currently, Facility Services has engaged a consultant to perform a comprehensive exterior envelope and structural review of the building, and the desire is to hire a CMGC while this review is happening. The potential for discovering unknown conditions is high and will require the knowledge and expertise of a general contractor to assist with completion of the project scope and development of the construction implementation plan. This project requires a contractor that has specialized skills and experience in building construction, project phasing, scheduling, and cost estimating on a high-rise building in Central Business District. The project phasing will be highly technical in nature and allows and needs to allow for ongoing demolition and construction activities in occupied spaces. Using a CMGC process also allows the city to negotiate with the CMGC a minority women and emerging small business subcontractor and workforce plan. This method has proven to be successful in achieving results and is part of the social equity contracting strategy that was adopted by City Council in July of 2012. The overall project budget is $7,667,000 and includes costs for design, pre-construction services, construction, and contingency. I will turn this over to Council if you have any questions, and a representative from Facilities is here to answer any technical questions.
You've done a wonderful job, but would you just describe for our audience again what CMGC refers to?
It's a construction manager general contractor.
So the Portland Building I was reading here was built in 1982? Is that?
Yes.
Okay, so it's been 30 years, I guess. So part of what I was reading is the seismic codes have changed in that intervening period. So that's one of the things that will be done, is upgrading seismic capabilities.
Right.
My name's Dale Cook. I'm the project manager for Facilities on the project.
We're seeing seismic upgrades. We're seeing some moisture possibly occurring in the building.
Correct. We're not sure of the extent of any kind of structural upgrades until we complete the assessment. That work is in progress right now.
I understand you're also changing the look of the building from postmodern to Victorian. I'm not sure that we can only hope. Agree with that approach.
For me, it's right up there with the Memorial Coliseum.
I was afraid I was going to open the door to that.
Demolition.
This is one I actually agree with Commissioner Leonard on.
How did it get placed on the historic registry if it's not 50 years old?
It was nominated by a person in the community. It went through the process at the state of Oregon, and then it was forwarded to the National Park Service. And it's basically a significant structure because of the designer of it, Michael Graves, and that's how. And it is true. It is very unusual for a 30-year-old building to be placed on that register.
Well, I like it. When you say the building meets 25 of code required capacity, what does that mean?
What was that again?
The building meets 25% of the code required capacity was in the...
There were some earlier studies done, I think, about 15 or 20 years ago. In that time, there was some correspondence from some engineers that made that statement. And that's one of the reasons where we're looking at it again. We're doing a very significant analysis. And there's also some great computer models that we can use.
So it was actually permitted to only meet 25% of the
Well,
seismic.
I that was a while back, and
I realize can't respond to that. Certainly not any of our fault right here.
Yeah.
But that's what happened, and that's why we're doing this upgrade.
It's hard to say. I think there's some debate on some of those comments that were made in the past.
And I may have missed it. What's the MWASB, the Minority Women and Emerging Small Business goals on this project?
So the goal, Commissioner, would be our current citywide goal is 35% of subcontracting. And traditionally on the CMGCs, we've in the past been more than 35%.
Okay. And it's the money's coming from the Building Maintenance Fund?
Yes.
How much money is in that fund and what is it used for? How is it collected?
I don't know if I can answer that, but generally it's collected from a portion of the rental income on the building goes towards a maintenance fund that's used for projects like this.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Does anybody wish to testify on 1149?
No one else signed up.
Okay. Please call the roll. Emergency ordinance.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you for your work. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Okay. Item 1149 is passed, and we move to 1150.
Authorize short-term subordinate urban renewal and redevelopment bonds on behalf of Portland Development Commission to finance projects in urban renewal areas.
Go ahead. Take it away.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jonas Beery, the city's debt manager. And let me start with just a little bit of background on this proposed action. The Oregon State Constitution requires that tax increment revenues may only be spent on indebtedness. PDC often issues long-term bonds that are repaid from tax increment revenues to pay debt service on those long-term bonds. However, PDC also funds projects on a pay-as-you-go basis. This means that tax increment revenues must be converted to indebtedness so that they may be spent on pay-as-you-go projects within the legal requirements of the Oregon Constitution. Like many entities in Oregon, the city uses a financing program commonly called de jure borrowing to accomplish this conversion. Simply put, de jure indebtedness is a loan with a very short maturity. Typically, it's one day. Today's emergency ordinance authorizes annual maximum allocations of de jure authority for each of the 8 urban renewal areas that expect to utilize the de jure borrowing program over the next 5 fiscal years. The total authorization is not to exceed $67 million on an annual basis, allocated among the various URAs as indicated on page 2 of the ordinance. I want to be clear that this action does not address specific projects or expenditures or make any changes to the budget. Because it does not authorize long-term bonds, it does not impact the long-term debt capacity of either the city or PDC. It's predominantly an administrative action that allows PDC to continue to fund projects on a pay-as-you-go basis within the requirements of the Oregon Constitution. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? So de jure bonds are literally paid in one day or can be paid in one day?
Correct. Typically, it's essentially an overnight loan. That allows cash to be converted to indebtedness, which then allows it to be spent within the requirements of the Constitution.
Is there anybody who wishes to testify on 1150? Okay, it's an emergency ordinance. Carla, please call the roll.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you for your work. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Thank you. Aye.
Ordinance passes. We're going to take a 5-minute break before we move to 1151.